the source of raw materials through mining and excavation, then you become much stronger. Anyway, as you can to the answer, and in a few, in a generation or two, we will know where we stand. Thank you.
I like the particular theory of the title, but I would like to have a kind of very interesting. Please, you?
Yes, Frank Drake suggests that N cannot be very large because of the searches we've already conducted. That obviously assumes that other technical civilizations will use radio radiation for some sort of communication, and that certainly doesn't seem to be obvious. I wonder if you would comment on that.
I think as you know, there have been many studies aimed at determining what is the most economical means for interstellar communication, and the answer comes out radio waves. And that is why radio searches are, we can consider the most promising, and why that is what is being pursued.
But that's based upon our present level of physical science, which is at this point very young.
It's based on our knowledge of limitations, which we think are a controlled situation, which include the value of the Planck constant, the value of the Boltzmann constant, and the level of cosmic radio emission. And we think we are smart enough and know enough that we have not missed any other factors that enter into this determination, but we could be wrong.
Please, discussion often on colonization. Essentially, you're leaving it now. We're sending Jupiter orbiter unmanned. It seems illogical that you would be simply for a civilization to send unmanned reconnaissance. We do that all the time, and you only send a reconnaissance, an army sent. So you would send with a local spiral arm, a little object which in the neighborhood of an interesting collection of stars and orbits in the around the galactic plane, and dives through and listens to interesting material. I agree, electromagnetic radiation, and 50 years our radio and television are going out, and they hear something organized, they send the signal gatherings and the signal back to the colonizer, rather than this human colonization.
I guess that the possibility is that N is very large, but there's not falling away from it. Instead, it's very active communication. But that's where the Hubble problem. And the act of communication is potentially available to us. And we have an example of how it could be viewed as a galaxy that we have not yet taken the right step to listen to, or really, that is an example based on light that we have had. Einstein in 1936 had a short note in Science magazine about the fact that sunlight and every star in our galaxy shines on every other star in our galaxy. General relativistic ray bending in the gravitational field of that exposed star bends the rays, bringing it to a focus behind the sun so that there's a pencil, an intense sun starlight, radiating in 10 to the 9th direction of every star. And yet the Earth has never intercepted a one of those in a time span corresponding to our technical ability to look for. By analogy, the radio wave, using the stellar lenses for an active communication system in our galaxy, with quadrillions of paths, if you've ever been in an EM area or focal zone. However, by traveling on the order of a light meter away from our sun, we could use the sun. And if we need to listen with the million to billion times of magnification potentially available for such magnification, in order to detect it at all, then we're not listening to the right
hand. Hello, gentlemen.
Lebensraum, it's generally assumed that the driving force for colonization is to have more room for people. I think that, in fact, the driving force for colonization is the greater access to raw materials, to energy, and to conditions where those can be used. So if we think about the colonization for space, it's not because we can pack a lot of people into great cylinders, it's because in space we find access to raw materials more easily. We have an enormous resource of energy in the sun, and essentially an inexhaustible sink in the direction of the sun and in the opposite direction.
in unique conditions where manufacturing processes can carry out, which can't be carried out on Earth. If we find those kind of things productive, then we will establish a civilization in the solar system, and by implication, the amount of energy that's available per individual in our civilization will be substantially larger. The number 2.5 times the energy per individual in 1974 is not striking a pretty great impediment to the solar travel.
Mark, Frank Drake about cost effectiveness. On first thought, it seems to be a very good concept to work with. On second thought, it is absolutely necessary only for the bare necessities of life. But all that makes life nice is luxury, and that never is cost effective.
For example, if we had it, we look for the fastest we are carrying. And a lot of us like sailing, which is about the slowest possible way. And so, space exploration, colonization, all those might come under a different category, not one of necessity, but one of luxury, one of what you like to do, what you want to do, no matter what it costs, and that is a different problem.
But, Drake, his formulas used a big agenda for the expansion of population, and of course, here on Earth, we would like to see that rather low. If for any reason we wanted to expand a space colony, wanted to expand their population rapidly, they could temporarily have a high value of gamma and expand quite quickly. In any event, once you have an interstellar star ship or spaceship, it's not necessary to have MSMC equals a million or billions. A few hundred or a few thousand would do it, and therefore the time needed to start a new colony is probably only 30 or 50 or 100 years, not thousands of anything. Using his pessimistic figures, he nevertheless got the time needed to spread across the galaxy at about 10 million years, not too different than the figure of 2 million I published a few years ago. However, if n is a large number, the nearest civilization would not have to travel all the way across the galaxy to reach us. It would only have to travel some fraction of that distance, and therefore both Drake's figure and my own earlier figure are apt to be overestimates. I'd like to point out that Drake has not given any reasons to believe that n is not a low number, only that we cannot completely disprove that possibility. As far as the cost-effectiveness argument goes, some people here seem to feel they know why extraterrestrial civilizations will colonize. They'll do it to be cost-effective, to raise their standard of living, or to get rid of excess population. I don't think we can know all the different motives they may have for colonization. Some of the others could come into play: a desire for conquest, for religious conversion, for glory, a desire to lend a helping hand to less fortunate civilizations, perhaps sheer desire for curiosity or excitement. All these are motives which we have seen here on Earth. There may be many more outside there. We cannot presume that they will only look at the cost-effective solutions.
That was Hart. It was Von Herner before him.
Where are the colonies? I find troubling the omission of the possibility that perhaps we are they, or we are one of them. In reply to the natural follow-on question, then if we are a colony, how come we haven't heard from our parents, so to speak? I would make an anthropomorphic analogy and say, well, like a beneficent parent, whether the human species or animal species, often the child is left to grow on his own for his own benefit and self-development. Perhaps that is occurring with us. To make a somewhat sublime analogy, perhaps the parent is, like often is the case on Earth, waiting for the child to come visit him, and that would be a sign of his technological growth that he could communicate back to the parent, wherever he may be. As to the origin of this colony, whether it's of a planned, conceptual, carefully planned, or whether it's of an origin analogous to what Tom Gold called the garbage pail theory of evolution, I leave that to others to discuss.
That was Eugene Epstein.
Sending us the last. Fight, not for you.
This approach seems to be regular and
which one is not. However, I think that all ideas must be present. The idea consists of a that life in the universe may rise as a vast only at a certain stage of the development of all the universe. A certain level of time interval of its origin. Life originating in those planets of stars whereby these time conditions, conditions are developed for the formation of an origin or it is determined at suitable temperature and humidity. This does neither earlier nor later this time interval life occur. This hypothesis for the past formation of life seems to be strange only at first sight. Considering it is assumed that life develops continuously during the existence of the universe, where necessary conditions are formed on any planet of any star. The combination of this approach was an explanation of life only by the structure of molecules and their parts. However, to explain life, it is necessary to take into account the structure before the space and time, which is defined by the state of all universe and possibly is changed within the space. The matter in the universe is not originate continuously. As the universe had developed due to past, now we are not surprised by this general statement. But when we should consider that life is created continuously with the development of suitable material conditions. A conception for the vast development of life doesn't contradict any physical law, and besides, the development of life becomes a more clear phenomenon. We shall see now that conclusions making based on this rather radical hypothesis about an estimation of the amount of civilization existing in our world. We assume that life in the universe began to develop 2 billion years ago. This follows from the connection of the beginning of life in the universe. From this condition, it follows that the actual difference of various civilizations cannot be very much. It is defined by the rate of the evolution from simple life to the intelligence and by an estimation of the point of the life beginning to the past. If we accept that the rate of the life evolution to the intelligence is similar, then the age difference is similarly equal to the interval of the life variation. If the rate of evolution differs by a factor of 2, then with the life variation 2 years before, the age difference between civilization and age nature can be limited. We make that the that lifetime of civilization is limited, and then the number of civilizations existing in humanity and diversity may be expressed as an amount of very formula. I must spend time
with that. What will be the danger or the still let me get this to do it.
This is where alone has something I don't only to make it.
Frank? Is this Troitsky?
No. Yeah,
Troitsky. Yeah, I was glad to see Shlosky, yeah.
This this may seem like one more data. Now is the existence of the map of the plane, which gives the condition for life for it. The very
old
Distribution P1, Drake distribution P2, we can then combine them. Furthermore, if you trust one man more than another, you can always waste them. probably by acting less immediately. A very simple case is the similar distribution of Gaussian, and then of course the logarithm, the average logarithm n bar is the sum of the expectation mean value for all the logarithms, and the variances are simply the sum of the variances. I took a few values in the literature for various people's estimates of these quantities, which is shown here. This means r star is 10 to 1.1 plus or minus 0.1, and so on. As we know, the big uncertainty is in the age, and here the age will be 10 to 6.3 years plus or minus 1.9, again based on 4 or 5 authors. This gives an estimate of 10 to 6 plus or minus 2, which means for 1 sigma levels, the number ranges between 10 to 4 and 10 to 8, and at the 2 sigma levels between 10 to 2 and 10 to 10, which confirms what we all know, that is that we don't know how many civilizations there are. I only want to reiterate a remark made by another speaker that if we're talking about detecting signals, what we really want is the time during which a civilization will use radio. And Drake answered that right now, that's the best thing you can do. That, of course, is no answer. We have been making fundamental advances in science for hundreds of years. There's no reason why we should stop now. And it may well be that in 100 years' time, radio will be particularly obsolete. Thank you.
Jump in the development of matter. It's very important. Our division of the good life, bad life, resuscitation, manifestation, and scanning. For example, it's quite possible to make the evolution of matter from lower stage of organization to highest to change from natural intelligent life to artificial intelligent life to giant computer, for example. And the whole strategy, science, system, and the estimation of the humanist is completely changed. In such situation, the pessimistic result of the absence of high developed civilization in our galaxy, I think, will be enforced because a special kind of discussion about the natural development will be essentially so. Maybe. But the time.
That's all right. You can take it up to about 11 minutes.
Up to 11?
Yeah.
Fine.
We
need that situation. I invite the people to go
I think we have to allow about 10 minutes for Dr. Morrison.
Maybe for another five minutes and then Dr. Morrison. Five minutes of discussion. If cost effectiveness can be relaxed, it can also be overcome by compensating advantages. We also have to remember that we've only known radio astronomy for 100 years and are discovering other things. At the moment, for example, there's a great push in Project Newman for deep water neutrino and muon and neutrino detection. And we have found certain compensating advantages for neutrino detection, which is also a speed of light. Now, one can't do it with current generation accelerators, but there'll be another factor of 10 in accelerator energies in the next 20 years probably, and in the few generations beyond that, the neutrinos may become feasible above the stellar background. So I think in the long run, there are many possibilities that we have to consider besides radio for communication.
In all the discussion that we've heard today, I've heard only two facts discussed in inverted commas. One is fact A, mentioned by Hart, that there are no intelligent beings from other space on Earth now. And fact B, the other mentioned by Drake, that the radio searches have yielded no positive results. I have to ask whether there's a fact C, or that's all we have.
Weird here.
But to continue the discussion of motivation, I got a letter about a year ago from someone called this.
I'll give them some data to think about.
An interesting suggestion.
That's some real data.
If civilizations around the star do persist sufficiently long, sufficiently often, then some of them are going to be very greatly motivated to get out of there when their star goes red giant.
Well, there was a comment from the audience about another fact C, and that is that we were here, and this is in fact very important because it sets very stringent limits on some of the probabilities of Drake's equation.
Well, if we are here,
and we don't know for how long.
It's of limited usefulness as long as the L stays in there. We talk about the lifetime of a civilization as if every civilization has a lifetime, and we argue about what that number is. I think that if civilization is successful in its evolutionary path, it is supplanted by a higher level of evolution, and the L becomes meaningless. But what is the L of a civilization in a galaxy which is entirely colonized? What is the L of a galactic civilization in a universe where many galaxies are colonized and interacting with each other?
I think this is our discussion postponed and the conclusion.
I hope it's not too indulgent to give his guest in summary, perhaps a critique or observation based on the historical fact, which is that this is just about the 20th anniversary of the time when a few people were first proposing these strategies exactly to the month. I mean, on August 1959, I suspect that at Greenbank and at Cornell and in Switzerland, we were more or less thinking about these problems in much this way. So all these 20 years have been prelude, and the stage is still the stage of prelude in the sense that though we have made wonderful pioneering searches, which in the first 2 weeks answered the then unknown question whether every star might not be sending out a 21 centimeter signal at a high intensity directed at us, which is something we didn't even know until 1950, early 1960. I would have to conclude that in spite of the, two things that have come to mind very quickly. First is that though 20 years is a long time from the standpoint of the papers, the astrophysical journal, and the way you publish next and the promotion of the arguments of one day to day, it's a very short time in the history even of science. Not much has changed. I heard almost no new arguments presented, certainly no new facts. The new facts are still the new facts we began with 20 years ago. I would add a fourth fact. There seems not to be any life on Mars. That's the other interesting point. Because before that, I don't care to say life is everywhere that can conceivably exist. Now I know that's not true. It's only in the least one. Not more than one half of those persons. We put it this way, is that if we find life on Mars, it will turn life from a miracle to a statistic. Unfortunately, it's not yet a statistic. It still remains in the possible domain of miracle. No one has spoken to that here. But I assure you, if you go out and tap the people on the streets, that will be a very large response that we're not going to answer by the kind of questions we make. It's the same remark that Mr. Skrovsky made for the entire philosophical conception. It's a qualitative difference, but not a difference in his direction, but in the opposite direction. Now, on the theories of exigency, the theories of the kinds of logical prediction of this ability of hydroatmospheres, and species, and all these things. Very little time. There's still a no point to control this problem. For those who make careful contemplative studies, which certainly should do every point of our knowledge, it is also worth putting in the fact, the probability, which the stellar evolutionists tell us, that the luminosity of the sun very probably has changed by about 30-40% over Earth history. Yet we do not see any sign of strange discontinuity in the life on Earth, in the geological record. Therefore, either the stellar evolution theory is wrong, which is not possible, since we don't see neutrinos either, maybe that's not, I don't know, or the cosmological limits are not so tightly put, or there are feedback mechanisms of various kinds so complex that we're very far from doing. I myself will say, as we've always said, these are maximally important to get all these auxiliary things, the origin of planets, the origin of species, right? They are part and parcel of all the sciences. The sciences, the natural sciences, are developing rapidly and surely towards better and better control of these things. But until we can predict the formation of solar systems, until we can predict the nature of our climate, until we can foresee the evolution of species and the change quantitatively, we are not prepared to say there's a final answer contained in any of these structures. Always going on. Putting these things forward, but they'll never be one. We thought then, and I still think, the best thing we can do, the surest thing we can do, which is statistically very poor, but is quantitatively very good, look at our own experience, is statistically poor because it's a sample of one. It is quantitatively good because it is real. You can't argue that it's based on some theoretical assumptions. There it is, we can demonstrate it as a fact. And the fact that it's going to draw this morning up nicely. That the speed, not of colonization, but of standing on the surface, is about 10 to minus 8 C at the present time. I would also, and that's a very small number, it would not be enough, even 1,000 times that is not enough to do the job that people are talking about in colonization ways, Jerry Gardner talked about. Moreover, the systematic and long-range exponentiating of scientific accomplishments and instruments is by no means a particular proposition. When about 20 years ago these things were discussed, the Arecibo dish was at least in play. The Arecibo dish is now, I believe, the largest and most sensitive radio astronomy dish in the world. It was in 1960 before it was quite built, the design by which we made the calculations. Things do not go, at least in a short time scale, as much as now, is everyone's guess. Is this a simple pause? Is it fundamentally based on economic engineering reasons or more complex? I do not know. I always say look directly at experience. This is a combination thing. Look at experience. Neither the Morse figure is much better, neither is anything better about radio astronomy except one thing. We know a lot more of what goes on up there, and we have enormously higher capability of data gathering than we have at that time, but we don't put too much use yet. Now, the argument also, where I've been, is at least proverbially ascribed to theory. I can't swear I've ever heard him say it, but it was a common discussion 25 years ago, this kind of thing is talked about. And again, I don't see that it as proceeded a great deal. I would like to make one remark, and the benefit of those who calculate, as Frank said, other people have done even more elaborately, the whole problem of contact and diffusion based on human experience and so on, can be done. Such sociological calculations are difficult to test by experiment. Almost none of them has given quantitative prediction to be verified anywhere, but I pass over that. I will say, however, that nearly all human travel, presence, and possibility of sending signals is accompanied by communication at a higher speed. Nearly all of us, if a jet crosses the Atlantic, the radio traffic to that jet, there's 1,000 messages across the Atlantic for every jet that goes across, even though a very well-traveled route with minimal need for such a improbable, in my view, that there would be any kind of extensive effort to travel, whether for economic colonization, people tend to talk about, or more plausibly, for individual luxurious travel, as Professor Van Hoorn pointed out, quite rightly, let us say for exploration, which differs only in the mass which is devoted to it, and therefore will be more spotty and randomized. It's extremely likely that those things would not be accompanied by much communication. In particular, there is no meaning to the existence of a common community to which investment and energy must be spent, unless there's communication among both of its parts. Without communication, it's very hard to even define a social situation. We do not have any groups of people who regard themselves as one and the same and make mutual contribution to each other without effort to physical communication. Therefore, I think that the division we see things is very artificial. And certainly one should be calculating what is the kind of message traffic that would be back and forth between all these exploration nor colonization, nor did them. How we might intersect that, and what, how tight might it be, and all these things have to be put in. And nobody has done such a nice study as that, I think, well enough. Though Bracewell and to some extent Stern have looked at the problem of probing, which is related to that problem. It seems to me that the model we tend to have is a model of, as indeed I would always say, all that we've said in this subject matter is primarily based on looking in the mirror. In fact, that's the fascinating part of the whole subject. It's opened up to the general scientific community, and to many readers, not scientists, who are used to this problem. A mirror-like image. What is our image of ourselves, our future, our past, our changes, our abilities? How do we see that? And when we see that, we can make inferences from it. And I feel very much, don't hear as much anymore, but 10 years ago, I always heard what someone said here, one of the two people also said it. It makes it talks, well, we destroy ourselves, the sign of interstellar communication is the ability to destroy yourself, and if the two are in conflict, and one is gained with the other with high probability. That, I think, is a decline, it's a state, obviously, image of oneself, and it is very little to do with the circumstances, and that's a possible challenge. But it is based more on the internal feelings than an external examination of the circumstances. The view we have here, however, is the military oversight is being kept by all these vast armadas that have for a long time and are now going on to something else. Surely that's unlikely. Surely the interception of radio traffic or other signal forms as they're approaching would be the very first sign of others, even if they were not really sending, though, of course, the difficulty of eavesdropping and direct communication must always be kept. Always kept the radio people strongly in mind. I would have to say that, like the economists said that all economic, that all statesmen rather, are people who profess great ideas in the name of some dead economist or other. And we have that cynical view of our world quite clearly. It seems in some way all of us who talk about these issues are really moved to face by a remark that we found in one of the dead philosophers. And I will enumerate a few of these to show you what I mean. And they're most interesting. And it's not to say that it was wrong. It's only to characterize the nature of thinking. You have to do this projective thinking, which we're all doing in this field where there's so little reinforced facts. The Aristotelian view, by the father of my poor Aristotle, is the view that we have a special role to play, that the earth is a different place from the rest of the universe, singled out in some peculiar way, and therefore the judgments that we make of uniformity are inaccurate. Today, Professor Tversky added a version of that, and it's interesting, is that it belongs rather to Hesiod than Aristotle, the version of their ages, like the Golden Age, when things were splendid, the Bronze Age, and so on. What we say is that there is some kind of reason for a rhythm in the universe, like the steady growth of the study of decay detected by light radiation. There's some other condition which make epochs different. The uniformity in time, which we assume in the equations, is of course denied by our present cosmology, though it still appears in the equations. And this conflict, that I like to call the Hessian conflict, is now brought up there. Interesting idea. The principal discussion on the antagonistic side, towards saying, well, it's not going to work very well, I'm going to find this out, has all been, I think, based quite plainly on the idea of malice. The idea that, especially human social beings, let alone other species, have an exponential drive to increase in some parameter. If it is not the population itself in a crude, malthusian way, then with Professor Papadopoulos, it's the size of radio telescopes. In my view, the lesson of ecology, the lesson of all speciation, is actually against that. What we seem to see is there's a stage where things are nucleating and they don't go very well, then there's a rapid stage of exponential growth, and then for reasons which are as many things as a phenomenon, there's a plateauing. And I judge that this is at least as good as any other generalization in the field. I don't know what the philosopher and father are on. Perhaps we can call it for purpose. And I think that is the one that I adhere to. Carl Sagan always calls rather provocatively, the assumption of mediocrity, the assumption that where you are is about where you're going to get. Not with precision, because we have gone further, but not that much further. In fact, the most characteristic feature of the human species is extraordinary uniformity, coded activity, and so on, over the entire span of technical possibilities, from people chipping stone to people disposing the radio telescopes. They really behave an awful lot alike. To be sure, they have many differences. Who would want to minimize those differences? But if you look back a little bit, you can also see great similarity. I would look to still not to ignore the lesson. In my experience, it's probably not the worst guy we can find. Really, we must be absolutely extravagant. The world is not all like the earth, the sun is not like the earth, and when we have reason to change our views, we should do so. And that, of course, is where the judgment comes in, why we can't make this into a firm scientific statement. But today, we actually have an introduction. I got a very interesting proposal. Let's leave the mathematician and physicist Gauss, who should be regarded as the basis of our distributions. There, too, I think. I'm sure the proposal would agree with it entirely. This is only a matter of convenience. We do not have a way to fit this distribution to the assumption of the linear of the equation, taken as a naive product of means, nor a more sophisticated integral distribution. We just don't know the answer. What is the evidence? What is the evidence of the science as a whole when you're confronted with two sigma results, the most quantitative we've heard, between 10 to the 2 and 10 to the 9? The answer is clear. In the presence of threatened God and that degree of inadequacy, what we need is experiment. What we need is straightforward investigation along the various lines that are suggested until we learn more so we can make a better projection. That is how I end up with it. Well, this began 20 years ago. If you don't try to find these things out in all the ways that you can find them out, using the best one you can at the time, being alert to the fact that that best one may change as you have lessons over decades to learn. And don't put all your eggs into one basket, apply the mixed strategy, that there is probably no other procedure which will get us somehow or other to an answer to this fascinating problem, which everyone's addressed with such a spirit and stimulating discussion as we've heard this week.
That, of course, was Morrison summing up the first of four sessions on SETI at the IAU General Assembly in Montreal, 15 August 1979. And I will end this side of the tape at this point.